Hi all and welcome to Sipfa Speaks, the podcast for public finance professionals. I'm Ursula Dale and I'll be hosting today's episode. On today's podcast, we're discussing the new GoLab Sipfa Value for Money Toolkit and the Legatum Institute's 2021 UK Prosperity Index. You'll hear from Dr. Mehdi Shiva, an economist at GoLab Oxford, and Daniel Herring, who works as Senior Analyst and Programme Manager at the Legatum Institute. Now over to my colleague Cal, who spoke to Dr. Mehdi Shiva earlier in the week about the use of the Value for Money Toolkit and its practical applications for people working in public finance.
I'm joined by GoLab economist Dr. Mehdi Shiva to talk about the new GoLab Sipfa Value for Money Toolkit. Thanks for joining us today, Mehdi.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So do you mind telling our listeners about your work at the University of Oxford's Government Outcomes Lab, GoLab?
Sure thing. Yeah, I'm an economist at GoLab. Basically, lead our economics research and policy agenda within the lab. Most of my work is around public economics and policy with a special focus on outcome-based contracts, impact measurements, effective partnerships, and innovative financing. Also to say that I see myself as an applied economist in which I seek academic knowledge to improve practice.
Great. And now GoLab and Sipfa have been working together this year to develop a new resource for public finance professionals. And it's called the Value for Money or VFM Toolkit, which was just released last week. So do you mind explaining for our listeners about the toolkit and why you think it's important?
Sure thing, yeah. Well, over my communications with policymakers and practitioners, I realized there is a serious lack of financial economic resources for public managers who are interested in outcome-based contracts and impact bonds. So I thought of developing a toolkit last year to support public managers with assessing the economic validity of outcome-oriented programs. And we actually drafted an early version back then, but I also knew that a tool just developed by academics wouldn't be as practical and impactful, especially that I was trying to target public managers. So I discussed the idea with Jeff, Sipfa's chief economist, who I'm in regular contact with. And we decided to seek out funding to gather a team together and co-develop the toolkit. That's how this project came into being.
And I guess, why do you think value for money is such an important principle?
Okay, so let me just say why it's so important at the current times. And I would say COVID has a role. First of all, COVID has ruthlessly showed serious flaws in our public system, especially public provision of healthcare. But this wasn't the first time we dealt with crisis, and it won't be the last. To get better prepared, we need to make changes and reform the system instead of repeating the same thing again and again by building back. COVID could actually be a wake-up call, an opportunity to build forward instead of building back. This involves with rethinking how value is defined and pursued in policy design. So maybe a shift in perspective to look at longer term values instead of short term costs and expenditure would be the change we need. This brings us to the second point. We know that we are dealing with huge debts and deficits at the moment because of all the expenditure over the time of the crisis. That means we should expect huge cuts soon based on experience. And the spending review in the UK is due soon as well. So the idea is to take a more outcome or goal-based approach instead of squeezing costs immediately. This could help with a healthier and more sustainable recovery. So the toolkit is a small step towards that direction to encourage public managers to think about longer-term effects of the intervention at the design to see the value in public finance.
Right, so an overwhelming focus on long-term outcomes rather than just immediate short-term costs. One unique feature of the toolkit is that it uses the National Audit Office's standard definition of value for money. Mm. So can you explain a little bit about why that's important and why it's relevant?
Sure. I would say for two reasons. First, NAO's definition is very well known and established across the globe, especially in international development, beside its internal usage in the UK, of course. And secondly, it's quite comprehensive and it goes beyond cost squeeze of output towards outcomes and equity as well. We were especially interested in those two criteria, outcomes and equity. So we decided to build on the already established NAO's framework instead of creating more noise.
And so coming to a close here, what do you hope that this new resource achieves?
Well, this tool is designed for learning and self-assessment, and we see it as just a stepping stone. We hope it promotes longer-term thinking of the effects of an intervention at the design stage. This provides a better picture of priorities, of course. And it allows public managers to play around with different factors to design the intervention in a way to provide maximum outcomes given their budgets. Also, I should say that this is not the end of the toolkit. We plan to further develop it with help from other practitioners and academics. For one, we just created a new peer learning group at GoLab in partnership with SIPFA called Value in Public Finance. The peer learning group aims to create a community of individuals and organizations from across the sector. So whether public, private, third sector, or academia, who are interested in improving public finance and how economies perform. We plan to hold quarterly meetings with the first one scheduled for 18th of November this year. So please get in touch with us and join the group so we could discuss around a range of exciting topics which are further described on our website.
And so where, for anyone interested in using the Value for Money toolkit, where can they find it? And I guess most importantly, is it free?
It is free, yeah, definitely. And you could find it on GoLab's website. You could either go to SIPFA's Value for Money toolkit page and find the link to the peer learning group there, or you could just go straight to GoLab's website.
All right, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll be joined by Daniel Herring, and we'll be discussing the Legatum Institute's work on the UK Prosperity Index, which measures the institutional, economic, and social well-being across the UK's 379 local authorities.
I'm here with Daniel Herring, Senior Analyst and Program Manager at the Legatum Institute. Thanks for joining us today, Daniel.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we'll go ahead and dive right into today's topic, prosperity. Your organization recently released the UK Prosperity Index. Could you tell us more about the index and what it measured?
The UK Prosperity Index is really born out of the Legatum Institute's interest and passion about prosperity. And this, we define prosperity really broadly. So for several years, we've been creating a global prosperity index that looks across the world at how prosperous countries are, not just in terms of economic measures, but in terms of how healthy and educated their populations are, how strong their institutions are. We are really trying to understand what makes a good life in these countries around the world. And so, as you would expect, the UK performs really well in that index, but as an aggregate figure, it doesn't tell you a lot about what's happening in different parts of the UK. And so the UK Prosperity Index really came out of a desire to understand the UK at a more granular level. And we also wanted to contribute to some of the debate that is going on in the UK about levelling up. So we ended up with creating a UK Prosperity Index. It covers about 379 local authorities. There's 256 indicators. We measure three big areas of prosperity. The first is what we call inclusive societies. This covers things like institutions, aspects like safety and security, social capital, and really is there trust in society and is there freedom to live your life in the way that you want to, as well as is the community life strong. Then we look at open economies, which is sort of the more classic thing you would expect in an index measuring prosperity. So we look at how easy it is to access finance, the ease of starting a business and running a business, how good infrastructure is, and also some sort of classic economic indicators like unemployment and dynamism, productivity. And finally, our final big area is empowered people. And here we're really looking at, do people have the access to the resources and the things that they need to live a good life? So we look at poverty rates and access to housing and shelter, access to local amenities. We look at health, education, and the natural environment. And so when you take these three things all together, underneath those, we have the 256 indicators that are attempting to measure prosperity and attempting to capture what it means quantitatively.
I mean, it sounds really comprehensive and interesting. So what were the main findings in the report, and were there any of them that surprised you?
Thanks. So there were four main findings. The first one was placing this in the context of the global, saying that the UK is already a really prosperous country. It's 13th in our global index and has been a strong performer, as you would expect, for a long time. And so when we begin looking at the UK prosperity index and what that tells us about it, what we found there was that sort of a lot of the economic measures that are often talked about are pretty strong and pretty good. And in addition to that, the things that are improving are education, natural environment, interestingly, and infrastructure rule have all been improving according to our index. And so the index confirms that many of the UK's economic fundamentals are pretty strong or improving, at least at an aggregate level. Of course, there are differences across the UK. But when you look at prosperity as a whole, some of the things that are being undermined are deterioration and things like safety and security. So this is really about things like violent crime. Then we've also got one of the other key findings was around physical and mental health declining over the last 10 years. And then also some economic areas that are less traditional, like declining labour market flexibility and worsening regulations for business, or at the very least worsening perceptions of the impact of those regulations on people. And then social capital is another area we found that there was a decline, as well as local governance. And what we found as well, as we were pulling this report together, we reviewed a number of other reports on levelling up. There's plenty of work going on by think tanks around the UK on this, and really a lot of the things that are declining, such as social capital or health, aren't really captured in the levelling up debate. And so we really wanted to put some of this forward. And so one of the other key findings of this report was our desire to begin to capture a different way of categorising local authorities. So instead of simple distinctions between the north and the south of the UK, or coastal towns and not coastal towns, we use some statistical tools to come up with different groupings of local authorities. So we came up with sort of 17 what we call clusters of local authorities that attempt to group local authorities that are like each other across the UK and can possibly learn from each other's challenges, but also learn from each other's strengths and who are facing similar challenges. So an example might be post-industrial urban areas that were industrial. Some of these are in the north, and trying to identify where these challenges are and where there can be common approaches to overcoming these challenges. So I think probably the main kind of surprising thing was that a lot of the challenges that the UK is facing are not traditionally talked about. They are outside of the traditional focus on infrastructure, for example.
Right. Now, you mentioned 17 different clusters of local authorities. So obviously, we have a fair amount of listeners that work in local government. So would you mind sharing how local authorities in the UK might be able to utilize the information found in the index?
Of course. Yeah. And we really hope that people do use this index. So I think the index is really there to help people ask the right questions. Its strength is in the fact that it gives you a broad range of information, and it gives you a comparator with other local authorities, so you can see where your relative strengths and relative weaknesses lie. And it's meant to point you towards the things that you might not expect to be challenges or might not expect to be the problems faced. Of course, it doesn't purport to tell you everything about a local authority. No index could ever do that. But it might say something like, for example, if you're a local authority in Liverpool, you might be thinking, oh, actually, it's not transport where there's a weakness, but it's health and education where we're lagging behind. Or if you're in rural Wales, it is transport. So different areas of the country will have different challenges. And the index is meant to just help you ask the right questions and it basically begin you on that journey of developing holistic strategies for kind of leveling up your area or confronting some of the challenges that you're facing. It's meant to be one tool of many that you would need to use in that process. It doesn't do everything. Of course, we walk into these local authorities with a lot of humility, knowing that we don't know everything that's going on as well.
Right. Now, you also touched on it before. Much of what we hear in the news these days is focused on the government's leveling up agenda. Could you elaborate on how the index could be used as a tool for leveling up more broadly?
Of course. It's a bit like what I said before. It's really meant to help local governments and national government ask the right questions. So I think that the leveling up agenda will need to be targeted, and it will need to allow different areas to focus on the areas that are weak comparatively. It will also need to take into account a broad range of things. You know, I said before that people's physical and mental health are deteriorating. So how does an agenda to level up the country take into account the fact that there are basic health outcomes that have been getting worse across the country? At the moment, that's being missed in the debate. But I think really these are fundamental, and just building infrastructure won't solve those things.
So your organization releases a prosperity index for nations, with the UK ranking 13th in the world. So how does the UK ranking compare to previous years? And what have been some of the biggest improvements or causes for concern over the last few years?
So the UK is 13th this year. It was 15th in 2010. So it hasn't gone up or down massively in that time. It's got a slowly increasing score, according to our global index. Obviously, the first thing to note, which I said at the beginning, is the UK is one of the most prosperous countries in the world, which is a obvious thing to say. Yeah, so the UK is obviously a really strong country economically. It's a centre of global finance. But some of its challenges in a global context lie in health, which we also spotted in the UK index. The natural environment, although it's been improving, is an area of relative weakness globally. And then I think also safety and security, actually. So it has reasonably some challenges there. Of course, all of these are much better than in many places. But for example, it's got a relatively high level of violent crime for a developed country, a relatively high level of property crime as well. And then within social capital, we've also noticed some slight declines in personal and family relationships. And we also have seen a decline in national government effectiveness. So all of these things kind of reflect things that other people have commented on around how the UK the last few years have been a bit tumultuous, even before the pandemic, in terms of the government's ability to enact its agenda. So there's been some declines there. And then also just a sense of maybe a slight fraying of social capital in the UK, although there's nothing to be panicked about yet, but it is something to be aware of and something not to be complacent about. In our report last year, we released a special document on the UK in a global context. And one of the things we said there was it's really important for the UK as a rich, developed nation not to be complacent, but to continue to take risks and look for opportunities going forward.
It sounds like the key takeaway is that the economic fundamentals in the UK are strong and improving, but there's a lot of room for improvement in social issues. So safety and security, physical and mental health, government effectiveness. All of those things need additional attention.
That's correct, yes.
So, Daniel, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
That wraps up today's episode, but be sure to tune in again in 2 weeks' time.